In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
This is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The first sign of trouble was a group of people, mostly young Hindu men, chanting, "Wake up, Hindus," and "Jai Shri Ram." It's February 24th, 2020, almost a year into Modi's second term. Nisar Ahmed, a garment shop owner, and his wife watch from their window in northeast Delhi. As the crowd draws closer, they set a motorcycle on fire. Nisar picks up his phone and calls a helpline.
I only called up 100 helpline because I could not go to the police. All the roads were blocked. If I'd gone, I might not have been in front of you today.
He tries to be inconspicuous as he ushers his daughter and daughter-in-law out of the flat to stay with a relative in another neighborhood. The crowd eventually disperses, but several men stay in the area, harassing anyone who appears to be Muslim. Night falls, but Nisar stays up. He sees people stumbling down the street. They look like they've been beaten. The next morning, the mob's back.
So the crowds come to our house at around 8:30, 9 o'clock. They attack the house right next to ours. Salman had a shop there, so we tried to dissuade them, saying, "Brother, why are you doing this?" As soon as we did that, all of the crowd started bombarding our place. They started attacking our home with stones, bars, sticks. They broke the shutter, and after that, the stuff in our house, our three motorcycles in our warehouse, jeans, jackets, they looted everything.
The rioters set fire to everything in reach. Nisar, his wife, and his two sons run up to the roof to escape all of the smoke. They jump to a neighboring rooftop. The crowd pelts them with stones, and they leap from rooftop to rooftop until finally a close friend, a Hindu, takes them in and gives them tea as they wait for the violence to subside. But it doesn't. The rioters find them a couple of hours later. Nisar and his family flee the neighborhood, and they never return.
No, we didn't go home. We couldn't, because there were so many people waiting outside. We couldn't pick any of our belongings up. We were barefoot, no slippers on. We left wearing whatever we were when this happened. We couldn't even find time to go home.
Even now, more than 4 years after the attack, Nisar worries it could happen again.
Life feels very different for us Muslims. Our faces now have this weird sadness all the time. And since 2014, 2015, since this happened, there's this fear instilled in our minds, an increasing fear about what's going to happen next.
This is something I often hear from Muslims in India, that they've felt a sense of unease ever since Prime Minister Narendra Modi was first elected, and that after his commanding victory back in 2019, that sense of unease has only grown. Early in Modi's second term, he began projecting an unapologetically muscular kind of power, literally. He'd brag about the size of his chest, 56 inches.
ये छप्पन सुनते ही कांग्रेस वालों की नींद खराब हो जाती है.
He warns terrorists and enemies at home and abroad that his government isn't afraid to enter their homes and kill them.
ये हमारा सिद्धांत है. हम घर में घुस के मारेंगे.
Two election wins have emboldened Modi. He's no longer holding back, and he launches into some of his most controversial moves yet. So how does Modi wield the unprecedented power he's been given? I'm Salima Shivji, and this is Modi's India Understood, Episode 3, The Strongman. So what is a political strongman? These leaders often use muscular, exclusionary rhetoric and strident nationalism. They invoke a more glorious but mythical past and abandon the long-held liberal ideal of equal rights for all. Modi has been called a strongman for some time, and just 2 months into his second term, he makes the first of two significant strongman moves.
Restrictions had been imposed across the Kashmir Valley. We are here in the Srinagar, where already during the night, internet services, mobile services, phone services had been snipped across the Kashmir Valley.
In early August, thousands of Indian troops pour into Kashmir. Internet and phone lines are cut. Much of the state is put under lockdown.
We are seeing huge deployment of security forces, particularly the parliamentary
and a law that guaranteed a measure of independence to India's only Muslim-majority state is revoked. But let me back up here. Jammu and Kashmir is nestled in the Himalayas. It straddles the border of India and Pakistan, and the two countries have fought over it pretty much nonstop since partition. And believe me, it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. It's also one of the most heavily militarized. Still, the Indian part of Kashmir has always maintained some autonomy, with its own constitution and its own set of laws. That's what Article 370 allowed, and that's what Modi got rid of. Kashmiris took to the streets by the thousands. The government's response was severe.
For instance, they use a weapon of a crowd control in Kashmir that's not used anywhere else in India, which is the 12-gauge shotgun, which fires birdshot out of unrifled barrels. This weapon has blinded people. It's killed people.
That's Ankur Patel, a writer and the chair of Amnesty International here in India. He's followed Narendra Modi's career for years.
So what you have today is more or less a province that is ruled under the gun, with a very large concentration of army and paramilitary forces that operate on a different set of principles than they do in the rest of India.
Critics have called the move unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court of India has upheld the decision, and it's been widely celebrated by much of the country's Hindu majority as a righteous use of strength. The second strongman move comes a few months later, in December of 2019, in the form of a piece of legislation called the Citizenship Amendment Act, or the CAA.
This is big. The Citizenship Amendment Bill has been passed by the Lok Sabha.
The new law gives undocumented migrants and residents from neighboring Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan a path to Indian citizenship. If they're Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, Sikh, Parsi, or Jain, but not if they're Muslim. The government says the CAA is meant to help people fleeing persecution from Muslim-majority countries, but its critics fear the actual intention is to single out Muslims who don't have proper documentation and that it could even be used as a pretense to detain and deport Muslims. The response to the CAA was intense. Protests broke out across the country, especially in the capital, Delhi, where university students from all religious backgrounds pushed back.
Parliament has passed the law, but you youngsters are all coming out and saying we don't want it.
Yes, because it goes against the very idea of what India is supposed to be, which is a secular country, which has always been a home for people of different faiths and beliefs. And this directly goes against that. And we, as the young generation...
The crowds were huge. There were hundreds of thousands of protesters, at times shutting down entire city centers. And this riled some members of the BJP, who called the protesters traitors and anti-nationals.
There were some BJP hotheads who went to the protests and threatened violence in the presence of the police, who couldn't do anything or chose not to do anything. Violence followed.
One of the BJP hotheads Akar is referring to was Anurag Thakur, the Minister of State for Finance and Corporate Affairs. He led a chant at a rally. That roughly translates to shoot the traitors of India. Another was Kapil Mishra, a leader in the Delhi BJP. On February 23rd, 2020, he issued a three-day ultimatum to the police to clear the roads of anti-CAA protesters. Soon after, he tweeted a call out for followers to gather in northeast Delhi. BJP supporters arrived with saffron flags, chanted slogans, and were accused of intimidating the Muslim residents of the area. These rallies quickly turned violent. Within hours, northeast Delhi was being torn apart by anti-Muslim mobs, including the mob I mentioned earlier, the one that attacked Nisar and his family. BJP supporters blocked off the main roads surrounding the area, preventing first responders from getting to the injured. And one viral video showed a group of Muslim men lying on the ground. They were being forced to sing the national anthem by a group of police officers after being beaten. One of them eventually died from his injuries. While the riots raged on, Modi hosted a high-profile visitor and friend.
He wants people to have religious freedom, and very strongly, and he said that in India...
U.S. President Donald Trump. When asked about the CAA bill and the ongoing riots, Trump said...
They have worked very hard to have great and open religious freedom. And if you look back and look at what's going on relative to other places especially, but they have really worked hard on religious freedom. I asked that question in front of a very large group.
The violence in Delhi lasted 3 days and ended with around 53 dead, mostly Muslims. Thousands more were displaced and had to stay in relief camps on the city's outskirts. Then the government cracked down on the months-long protests. Anti-CAA protesters were accused by authorities of inciting the Delhi riots, and they were locked up. The crackdown included anyone connected to the protests, including journalists and student activists.
That's where it stands. There are civil society activists who were not in the area at the time, who may have been added to some WhatsApp group, who spent 4 years, 3 years in jail because they haven't received bail, purely on the charge that they may have been part in some way of this violence, though there is no direct evidence to show it. So the government
used it. Some of these activists were arrested and charged under the controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, a counter-terrorism law. thousands have been charged under the act since Modi took office in 2014. So the crackdown cooled the protests. But what really brought them to an end in the spring of 2020 was the nationwide COVID lockdown. India, like so much of the world, came to a relative standstill. But north of Delhi, in the states of Punjab and Haryana, a different kind of unrest was stirring.
See, for the last 20 years, 25 years actually, since neoliberalization has hit the Indian farming sector, Punjab has been protesting for something or the other.
This is Amandeep Sandhu, a journalist and the author of Punjab, A Journey Through Fault Lines. And he's been following the issues facing Punjab for years.
So there is an ecosystem of protest in Punjab, so to say, because farmers have been repeatedly asking for various things from respective governments, and most often they are even promised something, but it is not fulfilled.
Punjab is the breadbasket of India because it produces 70% of the country's grain. But farmers there have been struggling economically for some time now. There have been compounding crises of spiraling debt and a suicide epidemic. And the stories I've heard there, they're heartbreaking. So when the Modi government passed three new farming bills that threatened to, in the farmers' eyes, hurt their bottom lines and allow large agribusiness corporations to gain further ground in the market, the farmers weren't happy.
Most of the economists, most of the agrarian, you know, experts were saying, oh, very good laws, very good laws. But the farmers knew that this means contract farming. This means we will not own our land. We will become labor on it. We'll become serfs.
This means the farmers' unions first started protesting in Punjab and Haryana.
What they did is they closed all the toll plazas, which is where the government earned revenue, you know, so that it hits the government. And they closed down all the petrol bunks and the shopping malls of the richy rich.
Then they stepped up their protests, driving their trucks and their big tractors towards the capital for November 26, 2020. That's a holiday that marks when the Indian Constitution was adopted.
On the way, the police had erected barricades, they were using tear gas, they were using water cannons. The farmers kept breaking all of them and they advanced upon Delhi. But not inside Delhi, they stood outside Delhi.
The protesters came from all backgrounds, but many of the leaders were Sikh, another religious minority in India. And they had garnered pretty widespread support. About 250 million people across the Indian subcontinent took part in a 24-hour general strike in solidarity with the farmers. It was one of the largest mass protests in recorded history. Modi tried to suggest that most farmers actually supported the bills and saw the benefit that they would bring to the sector. When that didn't work, his party took a different approach, painting political opposition as enemies of the state. Another strongman move.
Massive controversy over alleged presence of Khalistani elements in farmers' store. Day after Haryana Chief Minister Manohar Lal Khattar hinted at the presence of Khalistani groups, Congress MP...
Politicians started linking the farmers to Khalistanis, an outlawed Sikh separatist movement with a violent and adversarial past with the Indian government. And we could make a whole other podcast about the fraught and painful history involving the Sikh community and the Khalistan movement. But what you need to know for this podcast is that the movement for a separate Sikh state called Khalistan has been around for the better part of a century, since even before India's independence. And it peaked in the 1980s with a series of bloody events. It was in 1984 that Prime Minister Indira Gandhi sent troops into the Golden Temple. That's the holiest site in the Sikh religion. They had orders to flush out a leader of the Khalistan movement. The operation was a massacre. The government says around 600 were killed, but other independent estimates suggest it was way more than that. Months later, Indira Gandhi's Sikh bodyguards assassinated her. And that sparked a backlash. Thousands of Sikhs are killed in pogroms across the country.
And since then, since 1984, the Sikhs have not been able to connect with India at that level in which you feel, okay, this is our country. We are very happy to be here.
Then in 85, a bomb was planted on an Air India flight leaving from Montreal.
At daybreak today, the bodies of more than half the people on board the jet were still missing in the seas off the coast of Kerry. Every available helicopter was scrambled to help in the search for the bodies.
All 329 people on board were killed in the deadliest terrorist attack in Canadian history. One of the men involved, a Khalistani extremist, was convicted of manslaughter.
The suspects, Sikh extremists hoping for an independent homeland in India. Only Inderjit Singh Rayat ever served time for the crime. There are memorials across the country.
After years of insurgency in Punjab and crackdowns by the central government, the Khalistani movement and any discussion of it in India largely petered out until the recent farmer protests. Because now the Khalistan movement is once again the focal point of government suspicions. When the new farm laws were challenged in court, India's Attorney General argued that the farmers' protests had been infiltrated by Khalistani elements. Supporters of the legislation claimed in a hearing that Sikhs for Justice, which is an organization based in the U.S. that's banned here in India, was paying farmers to take part in the protests.
Here, Modi government found it just very convenient because their whole agenda is nationalism, uber nationalism, Hindutva nationalism. We are the insiders. Everybody is an outsider. So they got a good chance to put the outsider tag on the Sikhs by calling them Khalistanis, you know. Go to Pakistan.
Ultimately, the Supreme Court sided with the farmers and hit pause on those laws, sending both parties back to the negotiating table. Then, months later, Modi surprises everyone and announces that he will repeal the farm bills at the center of the protests. This was a massive win for the farmers' movement.
Mr. Modi has never taken back anything in his life as a CM of Gujarat and as a prime minister. So this was a big, big shift there.
For the first time since he took office, there was a sense that Modi's power could be challenged and that perhaps with enough pressure, Modi can even back down. But soon, the Khalistan issue would come back to the fore, and Modi would be embroiled in an international scandal that would make him look anything but weak.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away from murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
This is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In June 2023, a 45-year-old plumber is driving out of his Gurdwara's parking lot in a Vancouver suburb. when a white sedan blocks his path. Two men in masks run at his pickup truck and shoot him 34 times in broad daylight.
Canada-based prominent Sikh for Justice leader and Khalistani activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar has been shot dead in Guru Nanak Singh Gurudwara.
Hundreds of community members and supporters of the Khalistan movement came together, all to commemorate the life of Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
Hardeep Singh Nijjar was a leader in the Khalistan movement. He moved to Canada from Punjab in the mid-90s and then became a citizen in 2007. And he was an active member of Sikhs for Justice, the group accused of funding the farmers' protests. While the movement isn't as active here in India, it has remained alive within the Sikh diaspora.
In the 80s and 90s, a lot of Sikhs fled Punjab. These Sikhs have now lived abroad for 30, 40 years. They have children there who have grown up in these families. They carry an idea of India as a brutal state, which they have given to their children, which is what is intergenerational trauma. And the children see so many other movements around the world, like, for example, the Black Lives Matter, you know, right now the Philistine, you know, the whole Palestinian conflict, you know. And they say that, okay, we'll side with the Sikhs. We are Sikhs. We'll reclaim our identity.
This Sikh separatist activism abroad has been a thorn in the side of the Indian government for years. Modi has criticized Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for being too soft on those Modi deems extremists. And Trudeau has pushed back, citing Canada's freedom of expression. Which brings me back to Hardeep Singh Nijjar, the man murdered in that Canadian parking lot. The Indian government accused him of being a terrorist, of running militant training camps, and of being involved in an attack on a Hindu priest. Nijjar insisted he was innocent. He even wrote an open letter to Trudeau in 2016, calling the allegations against him factually baseless and fabricated. After his death, Nijjar's son told the CBC that RCMP officers came to the family home in July 2022 to warn his father that there was an imminent threat against his life and that he should be very careful. But the police would not say who the threat came from. And in the weeks before his death, Nijjar reportedly told friends that CSIS, Canada's intelligence agency, had informed him that he was a target for assassination. And so when Nijjar was shot, some people in the Sikh community started speculating that the Indian government was behind the hit. There was no proof of this, and the Canadian government initially didn't comment. But less than 2 weeks after the killing, India's foreign minister, Subramaniam Jaishankar, had a warning for Canada about how they handle Sikh separatist activism within their borders.
How Canada has dealt with the Khalistani issue has been a long-standing concern. Because very frankly, they seem to be driven by vote bank politics. We made it very clear, and I've done so sometimes even in public, which is that, you know, if there are activities which are permitted from Canada, which impinge on our sovereignty, territorial integrity, on our security, then, I mean, we will have to respond.
Relations between the two countries quickly deteriorate. At the G20 summit hosted by New Delhi in September 2023, you could see that tension. Modi pulls Trudeau aside for a stern word about Khalistani activism in Canada. And that was their only exchange there. Things were clearly frostier than ever between the two leaders. And then, less than a week after leaving India, Trudeau drops this bombshell.
Over the past number of weeks, Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
It was a shocking allegation that a foreign government would assassinate a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil. India denied the claim, calling it absurd and motivated. And the foreign minister said that, quote, this is not the government of India's policy. The reaction from Indian media was downright contemptuous.
Why did Justin Trudeau make a spectacle out of this? Justin Trudeau needs the support of a Khalistani leader to stay in power. So is it really surprising that he shields Khalistanis?
Now, Canada's intelligence is believed to be feeding Justin Trudeau wrong information. That is what intelligence agencies here in India believe. They also claim that agents that were hired by CSIS are reportedly from Khalistani groups. And they are the ones that are peddling these lies and feeding this misinformation to the Prime Minister and his administration there.
India is far more sure-footed in international relations now than it has perhaps ever been before. Trudeau may learn it the hard way, but so will anyone too lazy to take the time and make their peace with a new India.
India suspends visa services for Canadians and advises Indian citizens to not travel to parts of Canada because of what they called an increase in anti-Indian activities. Modi is able to avoid commenting on the matter, letting his associates deny the allegations on his behalf. Until the United States drops its own bombshell.
Hire plot. The 15-page indictment reads like a movie script. An unnamed Indian government official contacts an alleged Indian drug trafficker to orchestrate the assassination of a Sikh separatist in New York City. That man, in turn, attempts
It's a criminal indictment over a botched assassination attempt. The target, a New York-based lawyer and Sikh activist, Gurpatwant Singh Pannu. It alleges that an unnamed Indian government official directed an Indian national named Nikhil Gupta to arrange the hit. Gupta tried to hire someone that he thought was a hitman.
$100,000, but that hitman turned out to be an undercover DEA. So the indictment goes on to say that Gupta arranged photos and surveillance video of the victim's home and in June urged the source to, quote, finish him, brother, don't take too much time, push these guys, push.
The indictment also claims that in the hours after Nijjar's murder in Canada, this unnamed Indian official sent Gupta a video clip showing Nijjar's bloodied body slumped in his truck. And it alleges that a day later, Gupta told the undercover agent that Nijjar, quote, was also a target. And, quote, we have so many targets. The international pressure was mounting, as was the risk of damaging U.S.-India relations. Modi couldn't stay silent any longer, saying, quote, if a citizen of ours has done anything good or bad, we are ready to look into it. Our commitment is to the rule of law. So he's talking about the U.S. case, but that indirectly helped thaw Indo-Canadian relations a little.
I think there is the beginning of an understanding that they can't bluster their way through this, and there is an openness to collaborating in a way that perhaps they were less open before.
What does that mean? But
it means what it is.
This story is far from over.
Following many months of investigative work by the Integrated Homicide Investigation Team, with close collaboration.
Just weeks ago, in early May, police in Canada came out with a big announcement.
And other partner agencies, three suspects have been arrested and charged for their alleged involvement in the killing of Mr. Nijjar.
All three of the accused are Indian citizens living in Canada and alleged gang members.
Currently underway. There are separate and distinct investigations ongoing into these matters. Certainly not limited to the involvement of the people arrested today. And these efforts include investigating connections to the government of India.
When India's foreign minister was asked about the arrests, he talked about the suspects' criminal backgrounds.
In the morning,
Okay, I mean, somebody may have been arrested, the police may have done some investigation. But the fact is, number of gangland people, number of people with organized crime links from Punjab have been made welcome in Canada. We have been telling Canada, saying, look, these are wanted criminals from India. You have given them visas. They have come, many of them, in false documentation.
He went on to say that this was essentially Canada's problem, not India's.
No, why would we fear? I mean, if something happened there, it is for them to worry about.
We asked for an interview with someone from India's High Commission in Canada and the Consul General, but we didn't hear back. For now, the RCMP continues to investigate, and the Indian government continues to stand by its denials. But for some of Modi's supporters, the possibility that he might have had something to do with it, it isn't actually a knock against him.
For his core constituency, it would be wonderful. He would be the man. He's saving India, you see. It goes very well for him.
And I heard a similar sentiment when I was reporting on this story myself. A lot of people would tell me he didn't do it, but then add, well, if he did, that would be a good thing, because it would mean the Prime Minister is cracking down on those he considers threats to this country. Ultimately, in the eyes of many Indians, Modi has kept the country safe from its enemies, at home and abroad. And the BJP often brags about the lack of any major terrorist attacks in India since Modi took office. They say he's made the country safer. He's barreled ahead with more controversial legislation, recently implementing the Citizenship Amendment Bill, and weathered further farmers' protests, all while campaigning for a rare third term. In the face of serious allegations of extrajudicial killings, he's asserted India's authority on the world stage. And through it all, he's rewriting the story of India into a country that's boldly Hindu, unafraid of controversy, and where some believe democracy is under threat. That's on the next episode of Modi's India Understood.
And India will develop under him. Up to 2047, he'll be there.
2047. Wow, that's a long time for a prime minister.
This is not what Bapu had dreamt to be the India of his dreams.
A populist is a gifted storyteller, someone who can tell a false story well. The only way he can be fought is by telling a true story better.
You've been listening to Modi's India Understood from CBC Podcasts and CBC News. Follow Understood on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The show was written by producer Joytha Sengupta and showrunner Imogen Burchard, with me, Salima Shivji. Sound designed by Julia Whitman, with help from Dave Modi. Interview with Nassar Ahmed by Ayushi Shah. Story editing by Damon Fairless. Emily Cannell is our digital coordinating producer. Executive producers are Cecil Fernandez, Chris Oak, and Nick McCabe-Locos. In order of appearance, audio from Nassar Ahmed, One India, India Today, The Quint, NDTV, Mojo Story, Arjun Sethi, Associated Press, Narendra Modi, ITN, The Economic Times, First Post, News 18, ANI News, and the X account of Subramaniam Jaishankar. And thanks to Naheed Mustafa at CBC Ideas for her definition of a strong man.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.